It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Have you tried Verjus yet? That's spelled V-E-R-J-U-S. It's hot now, and it's an old saucing idea from the Middle Ages that's come back. Unripe wine grapes are pressed into this bright, clean-tasting liquid, almost a vinegar, but softer and a little sweet. You can find it in wine shops and food stores. Now, you can boil it down for pan sauces, marinate cherries in verjus with honey, cook carrots in it, or do a mojito with a splash of verjus for a great kick. Well, stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you think about it, everything we eat comes down to being either raw, cooked, or fermented. Now, the raw and the cooked parts are fine, but the really intriguing stuff begins with fermentation, like bread, cheese, pickles, miso, salami, tempeh, prosciutto, and kombucha. Sandor Katz lives to ferment. It's his life's work. He studied around the globe, and he has written a definitive book. It's for we laymen, and it's called The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. Sandor, good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today, Lynn.
So, Sandor, what is kombucha, actually?
Kombucha is sweet tea fermented by a very interesting community of microorganisms that's sometimes referred to as a kombucha mother, and sometimes it's referred to as a SCOBY, S-C-O-B-Y, which stands for a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast.
Mm-hmm.
And this produces a lovely, refreshing beverage. And actually, people have begun to incorporate all sorts of other flavorings and ingredients into it. So there's actually a huge spectrum of different, kombuchas that one could create or purchase.
We can do it at home, right?
Oh, absolutely. Kombucha is extremely easy to make at home. And when kombucha first began growing in popularity in the United States, when I first became aware of it in the mid-90s, I don't believe there was any commercially available kombucha. And it was just spreading as a grassroots culture, if you will, because the mother of kombucha grows with each batch that you make. And so all the people who make it regularly love to find other people that they can give kombucha mothers to, and it's incredibly simple.
It sounds like the mother is the zucchini of the fermentation world. But so how would we go about doing this, and where would we get a mother?
Okay, well, there are all sorts of trading posts online where, people who are kombucha-making enthusiasts and have more mothers than they know what to do with love to share them with other people. Mm-hmm. There are also lots of small commercial enterprises that are making kombucha mothers or kombucha kits available to people. And then basically all you do is brew some tea, sweeten it with sugar to taste, cool it down, put it in some sort of a wide mouth vessel that is not completely full because you want to maximize surface in relation to volume, and then just place that kombucha mother on top. Cover the whole thing with a thin cloth to keep flies and dust out but allow for airflow. And depending on the temperature of your kitchen, wait anywhere from a week to 2 weeks and keep tasting it because it will become increasingly acidic as days pass. So, most people like to catch it when it's somewhat acidified and still somewhat sweet, but that's really a matter of personal taste.
Now, do you remove the mother to stop the process?
Well, removing the mother does not completely stop the process because basically the mother is populating the sweet tea solution with the community of organisms that's doing the transformation. So really, if you remove the mother, another mother is going to grow in its place. And I think I neglected to talk about one ingredient that's also important, which is a little bit of mature kombucha solution in with your sweet tea. And what that does is it acidifies the environment. And really what all ferments amount to at a certain level is creating selective environments to encourage the growth of the organisms that you want and at the same time discourage the growth of other types of organisms.
So where do you get this kombucha solution? Is it just go out and buy a bottle of kombucha?
Well, for your very first batch, yes, you can go out and buy a bottle of kombucha. But once you're in regular production, you will always have some mature kombucha to add into your next batch. And really, a culture like this that takes on a physical form, a mm-hmm. SCOBY, ends up being a little bit like a pet in that it requires regular maintenance. You have to keep on feeding it. So, you know, each time you harvest your mature kombucha, you start a new batch. So it potentially can perpetuate for the rest of your life or
That's
beyond.
That's amazing. There has been, though, controversy over kombucha. What's the controversy about?
Well, I don't know which controversy to start with. There have been lots of controversies. The most recent controversy is that a federal regulatory agency tested some bottles a few years ago and found levels of alcohol in excess of 0.5%. And, yeast is part of the community in kombucha, and kombucha generally has, you know, some small percentage of alcohol. Typically, it's fleeting because as long as it's exposed to the air, acetobacter, which are also part of the community, these are the bacteria that convert alcohol into acetic acid.
Mm, into vinegar, essentially.
Exactly. As long as there's access to oxygen, these bacteria will convert any alcohol into vinegar. But once it's bottled, there's no longer access to oxygen. So there's the potential for greater accumulation of alcohol. So many commercial producers have had to alter their production methods, and some producers actually are not even using the traditional kombucha SCOBY as a starter. So I would call, you know, some of the currently marketed kombuchas sort of simulated kombuchas.
Uh-huh. So what are the options in terms of flavoring the kombucha?
Well, if you do what I have described as a primary fermentation, and then after you pour off your mature solution, mix it with some fruit juice or vegetable juice or some sort of an herbal tea solution, then you can have a short secondary fermentation that incorporates, fruit or vegetable or herbal flavors. And I've just tasted some really, really exciting flavor combinations that were done in this manner. Then if you seal them in a bottle, you can carbonate them and have a carbonated soft drink. Wonderful.
Thank you. Great primer. Thank you, Sandor.
My pleasure.
Sandor Katz is the author of The Art of Fermentation, and let me tell you, this one is a keeper. His recipe for kombucha is on the website splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, download our podcast, browse our recipe collection, and take a look at our ebook, Eating In. It's a quarterly journal of menus, recipes, tips, and opinions. And you're going to find everything at splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern are irreplaceable during travel season. They can lead us to the barbecue shack the locals love, but we outsiders just sail past on the interstate. Jane, Michael, what is the latest? Where have you guys been?
We've been to a wonderful old restaurant that's been around since 1928, the Blue Bonnet Cafe in Marble Falls, Texas.
I picture Marble Falls. It sounds like it's utterly gorgeous countryside. Is it true?
It's gorgeous, but I don't know where the falls name comes from. We didn't see any waterfalls. Where this is in the Texas Hill Country, which is beautiful in its own right, kind of nice undulating green hills, a great place to ride your horse if you're a rider. And it's also the site of some terrific food. Blue Bonnet Cafe is the place to eat it. Let me just say first off that when you walk in the restaurant, there is a large sign on the wall that says, try some pie. I automatically like a restaurant that has that advice for a diner. And let's start with the pie first, because they make a peanut butter cream pie that is just very creamy, not too peanut buttery, in a nice kind of soft graham crackery crust. What's inspired about this pie is that they serve it with a small paper cup full of chocolate sauce, so that you can either pour the sauce onto the pie or take a forkful of pie and dunk it into the chocolate sauce. The strategy is up to you.
I have to tell Lynn the weird way we eat at this place whenever we go there. We eat backwards. We're always afraid there isn't going to be pie left, so we eat the pie first. And then we have chicken fried steak and really wonderful freshly done fried okra. They also serve great old-fashioned yeast rolls. And I don't know yet. Lynn, have you ever eaten dessert first in a meal? It's not bad.
Quite frankly, yes. And and I've never regretted it. But I want to know about the chicken fried steak, because that is an art form that I fear might be waning.
A CFS, as they call it in Texas.
Yeah, and it's tough. I mean, those of us who travel around the Southwest a lot know all too well that maybe 90% of all chicken fried steaks that you find are pretty bad. The meat is frozen, they're gristly, they're really kind of second-rate food.
90% is being optimistic.
Well, when you find a great one, you realize that, I mean, this has never been proven, but, you know, most of the people who settled this part of Texas were from Middle and Eastern Europe. And I think what they were doing when they invented chicken fried steak maybe 150 years ago is that they were trying to duplicate Wiener Schnitzel. And what they had instead of tender veal was like a tough old hunk of cow. So what they did was to, you know, beat all the stuffing out of the cow until it was nice and tender, and then bread it and fry it in quite an elegant way. And
they didn't beat the cow. They beat
beat the steak until it was very tender. And, you know, at its best, and in the Blue Bonnet Cafe it is at its best, it's an elegant piece of food.
Well, I know. I've had them when they've been absolutely fabulous. Do they do the cream gravy with it, too?
Of course. It would not be a chicken fried steak without pepper cream gravy and mashed potatoes.
Oh, real mashed potatoes.
And fried okra and pie.
And fried okra. And cornbread
and
muffins.
And pinto beans, since it's Texas.
And those yeast rolls.
And the yeast rolls. And the pie. Oh, my God. That's a big meal.
Yeah, and it sounds great.
It is great.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stearns are the creators of roadfood.com. Now you can find information on their picks at splendidtable.org. Last night was one of those waste-not-want-not suppers. You've got to use up what's in the fridge because it's a sin to waste, was the mantra. Now, I don't believe pasta should be a dumping ground for whatever turns up. That said, I realized I had nearly every shade and taste of green, and they were naturals for a spring linguine. So I took the dark outer leaves of lettuce that I save for soup and often end up throwing out. I had some ramps, a few green beans, a handful of snap peas, and lots of chives. They're growing like weeds in the yard right now. We started with browning onions in a skillet, then the ramps went in, then the garlic and the greens and the peas and the beans, and they all sautéed until the greens were wilted. Meanwhile, the pasta water was heating up. So the linguine gets cooked. I stirred some pasta water into the greens, then added all the pasta, tossed it with some shredded Asiago, and it was a winner. So try your own improv. See what you've got in the fridge. And if you think you need, you know, a little guidance, I'm going to put notes on what I did up on the site. Just go to splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with Chapel Hill star chef Andrea Rusing and her key three recipes and monthly rice, an immigrant advantage. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We're up with our latest Key 3 star chef. Now, with Key 3, I take you into the kitchens of the best chefs I know. We essentially get a masterclass because I ask each chef to share their Key 3. That's the three recipes they think every cook should know. Well, this week we're with Chef Andrea Rusing. She created the Lantern Restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Andrea takes North Carolina ingredients and turns them into Asian-inspired dishes. Her food is sensational. Andrea won the James Beard Best Chef Southeast Medal in 2011. Grist.org calls her one of the 15 green chefs in the world, and the awards list goes on. Well, Andrea invited us to her house. Toddler toys populated the yard, and Andrea answered the door in a pair of jeans and a shirt, and she was wiping her wet hands on her apron.
Hey, Andrea, I'm Lynn.
Hey!
Three
is a magic number.
Her kitchen had space. It was airy, really simple, not a lot of bells and whistles. Long counters, a restaurant range, and a big window.
You get three. That's a magic number.
What are the key three for you?
The key three for me are turnip soup, overnight braised short rib, and tomato salad. These three things, if you can master these, all you need to have is some salt and some water and ingredients that are available anywhere, and you can have dinner very quickly, and it'll be a very direct, delicious, flavorful meal.
Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less.
So, Andrea, what are we going to do here?
We are making a soup with turnips, black pepper, rice, and a little bit of cheese. This is really a soup that you can come home from work, have nothing or think you have nothing in the kitchen, and just kind of stone soup it. It becomes dinner instantly.
Yeah,
turnips
yeah.
keep forever. It's an onion. It's a little bit of garlic, some rice. You can use water instead of stock, and some rosemary, which you probably have growing outside in a pot or some in your fridge.
And since you don't need stock, anything that comes, what comes from the tap is going to be the base of the soup.
Exactly.
Great idea. So, all right, so now you've got a big onion, and you're doing this into a tiny dice.
Into a tiny dice.
Yeah.
And then we're going to sweat it down in a little bit of olive oil, salt. And I think it's really important to salt the onion right away.
Why do you do that?
It just really builds the flavor, and it's really nice to just kind of go really slow on the onion, because that's going to really be a lot of the flavor in the soup.
Yeah, it extracts that moisture, and it seems to almost help it become sweeter.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got, what, about a 4 or 5 quart pot here on the stove, and you're filling it with a bit of the olive oil, right?
Yep, and then putting in the onion.
Nice big amount of onion.
A really big onion.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to cover it and just let it go. This would be the first thing you do when you walk in the door. While we get the rest of the ingredients ready.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the turnips that we're using are the purple top turnips, the kind of big turnips.
Right.
I love the Japanese sweet little turnips too, but these have kind of a spicier, more turnipy flavor, I'd say.
Now what's interesting is you're not peeling these turnips.
No, I'm not. If they were a lot older and the skin was tough, I would, but I might not make the soup out of it, because I find that when I peel turnips for this soup, a lot of the flavor and a lot of that spice and aroma is really in the skin.
So these are going to go in once the onion is sweated?
These are going to go in actually after the rice.
So just for an image here, you're cutting this into maybe, what, a half-inch dice?
Half-inch dice,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you lift up your spoon, you're going to get a nice bit of...
You're going to get a
several
chunk
different
of
vegetables.
But if you put the turnip in with the rice, the turnip's going to get mushy. And it won't be there anymore by the time the rice cooks.
Oh, I see. So you're going to really add this toward the end because you want that crunch.
And so this is Carolina gold rice. It's an aromatic gold rice. It's not really a gold rice. It's called Carolina gold rice, but it's an aromatic long grain rice that's grown near Charleston by Anson Mills. Any really good quality long grain white rice will do. And what I'm going to do is put it in a spice mill for a second.
Which I might call a coffee grinder.
Coffee grinder, yes. In fact, I hope I cleaned the coffee out of this the last time I used it. And just give it a couple pulses. The pieces will be about a third of their original
length.
That's
a great idea.
And then we're going to get this creaminess from the dust that we've made in there.
Andrea, this is really interesting because so much of your food is influenced by Asia. And Asian flavors, and this is a very typical Asian technique, grinding
rice,
isn't it?
It's true, and actually we do a dish at the restaurant that's a Vietnamese soup with fish sauce and shrimp and rice that's done like this, broken up in a mortar and pestle with pea greens, And so that's kind of what gave me the idea to do this, just trying to make something go faster, but also kind of get that creamy, rich, thick texture without dairy and in a healthy way and without overpowering the vegetables. And so we're going to add the rice in and give it a stir, and then just let the rice cook a little bit to give it a little bit more of a head start on the turnip.
Right.
And now I have a little white wine. And it's not going to taste winey in the end. It's just to give it a little bit of acid.
I don't even want to think about that measurement. It's just a several glugs, right?
A glug.
About four glugs.
And then I'm going to let this go for a minute.
Right.
And then we're going to throw in a whole branch of rosemary and cover it up again.
How did all the Asian influence get into your food?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey, and report card dinners were always going to Chinatown. And so I just always loved Chinese food growing up.
Uh-huh.
And when I moved here, I really missed that Chinatown experience. And I found also when I was opening a restaurant that I really wanted to fill a need in the community because I really wanted to make it sustainable and stay in business. And so, you know, thinking about what to do, I felt like what people really responded to here when I cooked, I did catering and did special meals, was Asian food, and so I decided to do an Asian restaurant. So we're going to put these little turnips in.
Okay. This looks like, with the ground rice in a lot of chopped onions, it looks like there's a white confetti among the onions. And now the chunks of the turnip with the purple and white skin on them. So how much water are you adding?
I'm adding about a quart, but I always start with less than what I think I need, so I can end up adjusting the consistency at the end with more water. I mean, it's not like you're going to run out of water, so you just adjust it at the end, and you start with less than you think you need.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
So the soup is bubbling away, and you're going to finish this how?
I'm going to ladle the soup right from the pot into a bowl, and I'm going to finish it with a little bit of grated aged cheese. I'm going to use some pecorino. You could use cheddar or parmesan. Some fresh rosemary needles, just chopped up a little bit, and a lot of black pepper.
So we got water, some rice you grind in a coffee mill, right? Some turnip, onion, and then the finish.
Stone soup.
You got it.
It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners, every triangle has three sides.
No. Andrea Rusing is chef owner of The Lantern in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's author of Cooking in the Moment. Now, to get Andrea's recipe for that stunningly simple turnip soup with rosemary and black pepper, and to hear the rest of our conversation about her key three dishes, go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know, there's no question that as new immigrants come here, we're intrigued by their foods, their status in discovering that first Peruvian place in town. But often there's an assumption that newcomers want to learn about how to live from us instead of us learning from them. International journalist Claudia Kochler has another take. She lays it out in her book, The Immigrant Advantage, What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope. Claudia, good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You know, in your book, you talk about different aspects of immigrant life, saving money, courting, families, socializing, living together. But there is one thing that you talk about that's intriguing. It's called monthly rice, and it comes out of the Vietnamese community.
Sure, and I will even attempt to say it for you, although I don't get the tones correct, but it's called Com Tang, C-O-M, space T-H-A-N-G. And the basic idea is subscribing to meals that traditionally are delivered to your house, and you can subscribe on a monthly basis. They are cheap, homemade, composed of the freshest, least expensive things from the market that day, and they're for working families who still intensely value eating together, even if it's 9 o'clock at night, and eating real food.
Well, but what's the difference between this and just you know, setting up something with a restaurant.
Right, or takeout, essentially, right?
Yeah, essentially.
There are two big things. One of them is that it's not restaurant food. And even in Houston, some restaurants do monthly rice. You really have to ask around, but the cuisine is different. And this is where one of my many guides for this book really spelled it out for me. It's not fancy. It's not beautiful. It's got less salt, less oil. It's there are fewer crackly, crunchy, deep-fried things that may be more expensive to make.
Mm-hmm.
So the food is more simple. It's home food. It's also food that does well if it's heated for a long time. There are things that are braised, not flash-fried.
Right.
Because they're for working people who get home, and they might even be eating them later on in the evening. So that's the one thing. The other big difference is the price. It's extremely inexpensive, and the price may have crept up over the years, but it's still, when I did it with my family, we got a meal for four people for $8, and that included delivery. And the way it's so cheap is that, again, it's simple food. You don't have a lot of say. They have a great repertoire, the people who do this, but they're basically cooking what's the best deal and what's most economical for them that day. So the only obligation is it has to be so delicious that you keep on paying your subscription.
And is this something that comes out of Vietnam, or is it something that's evolved when people came to this country and, you know, started working?
It is something that came from Vietnam, and it evolved in the United States, too. And what I was told was it was often for male scholars or people in the military who still had been raised with this ethic. You eat with your family at night, and in fact, there's something unwholesome, unhealthy physically and perhaps even spiritually / psychologically about eating alone. It's just bad practice. And so in Vietnam, traditionally, these guys would get delivered to them, or even more intriguingly, they would pay a subscription to eat with a family in order to have the family experience along with a meal. And that I knew one person who did that in the United States. He went to school in the Midwest, and his parents found him a Vietnamese family with whom he could have dinner. And there's a little extra tradition attached to this, which still lives on, which is if you are a homemaker and you're making a little extra money by bringing in a young student to eat a meal with your family every night, why not choose the best, most promising student who is most outstanding in his studies just in case your daughter and he fall in love?
It's an interesting way to case out a future son-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad thought. Who does this?
In Houston, which is where I really studied it, and also in California, lots and lots of people do it, and it's professionals. These are the consumers. It's really exclusively Vietnamese, and it was hard for me to break in, but so worth it. It's people who work long hours. It's inexpensive, so sometimes it's people who don't make a lot of money, but it's also doctors and lawyers and women engineers who still have this traditional expectation that they're going to provide food for the family, even though they're working as long hours as everybody else.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Claudia.
Thank you.
Claudia Kochler is author of The Immigrant Advantage, What We Can Learn from Newcomers to America About Health, Happiness, and Hope.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
Well, it's time to turn to your calls. Pick up that phone. Call us, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who's up. We have Alona calling from Pembroke Pines, Florida. Alona, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Pleasure to talk to you today.
Good to talk to you.
I've been devouring, pardon the pun, your cookbook, and I made the Moroccan preserved lemons. I've been doing a lot of pickling lately. And I was raised by my great-grandmother, and she lived through Germany in both World Wars, and I just hate to throw anything out. So I hear her voice in my brain when I throw something out, because I'd have to listen to how they had to make soup out of potato peels, and you'd have to listen on and on. So what can I do with the juice that's left over? Because it looks delicious.
Okay. I think, why don't we quickly explain what the preserved lemons are about, though, because a lot of people may not know about them. Mm-hmm. The preserved lemons, it's from Morocco. It's an ingredient that's used in all kinds of things, and you can put it in salad dressings, you know, marinades, stews, soups. And what it is that it's essentially you slash several lemons and you pack them in salt. And our recipe, which is from my cohort in crime, the show's producer, Sally Swift, also has spices in it, whole spices. And you pack that away with juice. And what happens is the lemons absorb all of that salt and they turn into something that's sort of beyond the sum of its parts. Mm-hmm. And you use them in small quantities. Now, the juice has a lot of salt in it, but it also has all of that bitter, tart, lemony quality. And what I would do is, first of all, it begs to be part of a salad dressing, not the entire dressing, but part of it. That's kind of obvious. But you know where I think it would really be fabulous? Mm. Think about boiled new potatoes. You know, the little potatoes, you can even use whatever you've got. But
fingerling, yeah, absolutely.
Fingerlings, and you want the boiling potatoes, the ones that are kind of waxy, not the russet baking potatoes.
Right, right.
And you just would boil those until they're just tender, slice them, and while they're warm, sprinkle them with that juice and a little olive oil. I just think that would be so incredible.
That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, I would marinate things in it. You know, like, think about brushing that over ribs.
Maybe with some fish?
Fish, absolutely. Take it easy, though. You know, 15 minutes at most with the fish, because it's really intense.
Oh, good.
But if you think of, you've got salt, lemon, bitter, and this mysterious, right, very delicious, almost funkiness, wherever you want to put that. A little bit in a soup would be great. I think it would be fabulous in a tomato soup. Finish it.
Oh, wow. Like a finishing. Yeah, that'd be
good. Just a few tablespoons. It would be just great.
Well, I have another week to wait. It's been taunting me for my kitchen counter, but
they take time, but you know what? They last a long time. So it's going to be worth the wait. Just think, you're doing no work. They're doing all the work, absorbing all that great stuff.
Hey, very much looking forward to it.
Thanks for a great question.
Oh, thank you.
You take care.
You too.
Bye. Well, the weekly trivia challenge is up. Now, this week's question is, what is sweet and carries things up and down? Well, we're going to be back with that answer and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, so get in touch. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Or you can actually call us on a phone. 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what is sweet and carries things up and down? Brace yourself. It's a lickable elevator. Yes, the walls of the elevator are coated with cupcake tops that you can lick. But you have to go to London to do the licking. To help relieve workers' stress, a company there paired up with a cake baker to create the world's first lickable elevator, and probably its last. The inspiration? The Willy Wonka movie. And the yuck factor? Well, if you believe the PR, as soon as the cake is licked, it is removed. Still, I'm going to pass. Well, it's time to get back to you. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or call 800-537-5252. We have Julie on the line from Pennsylvania. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Lynn. I am calling about my culinary group. We've been together for many years. Mm-hmm. There are about 10 of us, and we always try to come up with a new theme. And each hostess, when we rotate hostesses, comes up with a theme, and I was sort of stuck, and I thought, who else to ask but the lovely Lynn about any ideas?
Thanks, Julie. I've just drawn a complete blank.
Well, I did think of one thing that we haven't done,
yeah.
Because, of course, our group, you know, we've been together so long, we meet monthly, and I was thinking about Sweden, because I have actually traveled there during Christmas time, and I loved the food. And I'm hostessing the end of the month, and I just thought I'd ask you some ideas about that.
Oh, I think it would be fabulous to do Swedish food. Are you familiar? There's actually a PBS show, and I can't remember the name of it, but they rotate chefs through it. But Andres Wistad is one of the hosts. He is a Scandinavian chef and very well known there, chef, food writer. Wonderful on screen, but he did a fabulous book called Kitchen of Light. Isn't that the most wonderful name for a book?
Yeah.
and it's not specifically Sweden. It's a bit broader than that.
Mm-hmm.
But his food is fabulous. His food makes you so hungry. So the first thing you want to do right now is to get yourself some aquavit. And start infusing it with flavor.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So if you're going to do, you know, if we're going to go down the aquavit trail, usually you want to put some, I'd say spice it. I would do clove and cinnamon stick, lots of black pepper, a couple of big curls of orange rind. And I'd put that in the aquavit and I would let it steep. And you could even leave it in there if it looks good, you know, if it looks really pretty. And that's what you're going to have as a starter, very cold, served in tiny glasses. And with that, you're going to do your own home-done gravlax. You know, have you ever done them? Have you ever done gravlax?
No, I've eaten them in Sweden, but haven't done them.
Oh, they're fabulous. This is where you get a fillet of salmon, okay? And depending on how many people you have, I always do about 3 pounds because it freezes well, believe it or not. You'll find recipes for this all over the place, and there are many versions. The classic one is more or less equal parts of coarse salt, kosher salt or even coarser, with sugar, cracked black pepper, a generous amount, and you take your salmon, you cut it so that you have two equal-sized pieces. You want the thick cut of the center of the salmon, if you can get it. You put it in a glass dish or something that's not going to react, so a pottery dish or a glass dish, okay? Put together a lot of this mixture, and you rub some of that, pile it onto the flesh. You put the one piece of salmon skin side down. You then really pile that onto the flesh, and then you put a ton of fresh dill there. Then you put the other piece on top, and then you put all the rest of this over it and around it and under it, all the rest of that seasoning with dill, and you weight it down and you put it in the fridge for a minimum of 3 days.
Okay.
And it'll cure. And then the idea is you slice it very thinly across the grain. You just pick it up from the skin. And you keep it pressed and you keep bathing it in the, it's going to throw off a lot of liquid. You can keep bathing it in that liquid. You can keep it up to about 5 days, even six in the fridge. After that, I like to freeze it. And it really freezes beautifully.
And how about dessert? What do you think would be the perfect?
Oh, boy. Well, I keep thinking of cloudberries, but they're not easy to get. You know, I would do something with strawberries or cherries. And I'm wondering if you don't want to do kind of a mix of sour cream and sugar and nutmeg and some fresh cheese and then layer chunks of strawberry that you've sugared and you've added a little bit of that aquavit to and let it sit so it almost – and then cook half of it so it's almost jam-like. And layer that with that cream. Make a parfait. And then top it with the uncooked combination because the strawberries will have thrown off so much of their juices. And I'm not sure how Scandinavian that feels, but I always think of fresh cheese and that kind of thing with it. And then, of course, slow-roasted lamb would be one thing to consider.
roasted pork is just incredible there.
Mm-hmm.
But lamb is in season, and it would be great to do lamb, maybe with roasted young turnips.
Mm.
Yeah, because, you know, think of root and leeks. It would be just delicious. So that gives you a good idea. Oh, one other thing. There's a great Swedish dish, which is potatoes and anchovies. Don't turn up your nose. It's really good. called Johansson's Temptation.
Ooh.
And if you look that up, you will. It is so delicious. Slices of potatoes layered with anchovies and baked in a, you know, in like a gratin with lots of butter. Lots of butter. It's so fabulous. You'll just love it. There you go. You're done.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate it.
You are welcome. Have a great party. Bye.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Dick is on the line from Ithaca, New York. So, Dick, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my wife mostly does a really big garden, and last summer we did a lot of drying of vegetables in one of these little less than $100 tray dryers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we have plastic bags and bags of tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash.
And the next season is already here, right?
The next season is already here. Yeah. We've used them pretty well. But I feel like I'd like some new ways of using them. I've just sort of put them in soups and stews and things. And
right.
I think they're wonderful. I think it's something that a lot of people might like to do. They talk about sun-dried tomatoes, but the machine, these little dryer tomatoes are terrific.
You know, I think it'd be great if you tell us about the great things about them because, you know, people think of drying tomatoes, but they don't think of drying peppers or eggplants. And you see this in the Mediterranean a lot, you know, which is logical because what do you do when you have extra eggplant or extra zucchini? But the flavor is different, isn't it? Even when you do put them in the soups and the stews, isn't it more intense?
I think it is more intense. It comes out, I've made a pumpkin soup and added in a bunch of these tomatoes and peppers, and I really need no other seasoning to it.
Wow.
It's so vibrant.
What a great idea for building flavor,
you know? Mm-hmm.
Okay, what else to do with it? Well, I can't imagine anything more exciting than doing a tomato sauce with two kinds of tomatoes. Do you know what I'm saying? A fresh tomato or even a really high-quality canned tomato, but then the bulk of it is the dried tomato that you're rehydrating in that sauce. The intensity.
Yeah, people think that the rehydrating is a big process, but it's not. You put it in a sauce, and 10 minutes later, they're delicate and... you know, and then if you cook them for half an hour, they're kind of coming apart like any tomato would.
Right. I don't think you necessarily need a lot of liquid, do you?
No, they don't need a lot of liquid, no.
If you were to do a slow sauté of onions and peppers, you know, and you know, with oregano, whatever, do it an Italian-style thing, and then add up the broken up or the chopped up dried peppers or whatever, dried zucchini, the dried eggplant, and add a bit of water to that or broth, whatever liquid you like, and let that braise down, you would have a fabulous stew.
Mm, yeah,
and
that sounds good.
You know what I'm saying? It doesn't need to be even stew-like. It can be moistened because as you cook off that liquid after everything is softened, you're going to get a glaze on that food that's going to be just fabulous. So think of layering it with its fresh counterpart. As the season comes on, and you can be building flavors that you just couldn't get any other way.
Yeah, that sounds good.
And I think
I like the eggplant actually better than fresh eggplant myself.
Oh, this sounds great. But I think you've come up with something that is a wonderful way to add, first of all, nutrition, but intense flavor. And it's so easy to do. And then you can be storing whatever you've grown or whatever you found at the farmer's market that's super cheap in season, and you can have it year-round.
Right,
Dick,
right.
Dick, you have done...
quite a few tomatoes in that dryer.
Dick, you've done a public service.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. This is a great idea. I hope what we talked about is going to help you.
Thanks very much.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. How far would you travel for the first perfect tomato of summer? Would you take a day or two out of your life just for that first taste? Now, would you do that for a pea? Well, if you would, then you're in Elaine Sciolino's league. Elaine is a correspondent at the Paris Bureau of the New York Times and writes the monthly Letter from Paris for the Times Dining section. Well, she's calling in from Paris. Elaine, hi. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You did this article on the French and peas. Now, what brought this about?
I really never was really that much into peas, but one of my friends is a sort of Rabelaisian character named Jean-Claude Ribault. He's the food critic for Le Monde, and he said, you know, I'm going to go down to Provence because I have to eat peas. And I thought, well, you know, I have to start this new gig with the New York Times, this Letter from Paris, and can I come with you? And he said, sure. It's the best kind of journalism to have somebody lead you by the hand who really knows the turf and open doors for you.
So what happened? I mean, what did you guys learn?
Well, we went to a place where it's been there forever, where they have a garden right outside the restaurant. And so we, watched as they picked the peas from the garden and put them into the boiling water and transformed them into magic. You know, I didn't know that you could make pea pods edible. I knew about snap peas and snow peas, but who knew that you can take a regular tough pea pod and a sharp knife and skin the inner kind of plastic cellulose out, and the outer heavier skin can become like a little boat, and you can stuff it in with peas and decorate your plate, and it looks like you've got like little pea passengers in your boat.
And the pods taste fabulous?
And the pods taste fabulous. I even went to the greengrocer in my neighborhood in the middle of Paris, and I said, I bet I can teach you something. He said, you can't teach me anything about vegetables. And I said, did you ever eat a pea pod in your life? And he said, you can't eat pea pods. And I said, watch. And I did it, and I fed it to him, and, you know, I felt like Julia Child.
So who were the chefs that you went to, and what were they doing with the peas?
What's so wild about this place, it's a very old place. It's called Lousteau de Beaumanière.
Oh, this is down in
yes,
the south
yes.
of France.
Well,
very famous.
Well, the chef is Pakistani-born, and he came to France as a child because his father was in the French Foreign Legion and was exposed to food in the military mess for the French Foreign Legion, and he and his brother became chefs. So it was wild, you know, asking this Pakistani-born guy, so how did you come to love peas? Because we started talking about how, you know, in his backyard when he was a kid, they grew okra and eggplant. And he showed me how you can skin a pea. Never in my life did I think about skinning a pea, but it's a very sort of sensual experience because you take the pea that's been plunged into boiling water, then plunged into ice water, and it comes out, and you take the pea between your thumb and your index finger, and you roll it around slowly, and the skin pops out, and the pea splits in half, and you have this beautiful, skinless, naked pea. You know, it's not something that you want to do if you've got guests coming in a half an hour, but if you're watching, you know, Mad Men or something, it's the perfect time to sit there with a bowl and skin peas.
So then do you just toss it with butter or do you do
anything? Yeah, well, it's the easiest thing in the world. You just, you know, a little bit of onion, a little bit of carrot, a little bit of pork belly or bacon and a lot of butter, and the butter kind of makes this emulsion with the pea, and that's it. And you can't ruin it unless you overcook it.
This sounds incredible.
It's great.
So, Elaine, you're living in the middle of Paris. What's happening now with food there?
You wouldn't believe what's happening with food in Paris. Paris has gotten brunchified. I mean, every corner bistro seems to have a brunch on Sunday afternoons. And so what you're seeing is lots of hamburgers, smoothies, bagel sandwiches, and cupcakes.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
I mean, this is what's going on here.
Philadelphia cream cheese on frozen bagels that are flown in from London. Do you believe it?
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Is the baguette going to be dead?
The baguette won't be dead, but this is really an invasion of the round-breaded substance, yes.
I like seeing it through your eyes. This is great. Hey, Elaine, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and let's do it again.
Elaine Cialino is a New York Times contributor based in Paris. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. He said, "We lived very simply, but with all the essentials of life well understood and provided for. Hot baths, cold champagnes, new peas, and old brandy."
The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Get registered for our monthly book giveaway, download our weekly podcasts, make a visit to our online store, and don't miss our newest publication, a quarterly ebook called Eating In with Lynn. You'll get a menu, recipes, tips, and of course, opinions. You'll find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.